Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. This episode of Pardes Live and Miniseries features Rav Mike Foyer. For more information on how to download more podcasts, visit elmod.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, PARDES.org.IL, for helping make this class happen. Okay, good morning. Last class, I think I left a couple of people limping from the sort of philosophical frames there. I just want to tell you that it won't always be like that, but I can't promise that it'll never be like that again. What I'd like to do today in big picture is, first of all, give at least a working definition of early modernity in order to understand what's the time period we're in. And then we're going to begin now and for several weeks to follow the various tracks that the exiles from Spain took as they began to spread out, actually not just across the Mediterranean, but really across the globe, because that's going to be one of the things we need to touch on today, that one of the hallmarks of early modernity, of course, is now that in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, that we have now actually have a globe, something which is going to take increasing importance, which I hope that we all take for granted, although apparently the flat earth community is on the rise. Okay, so first things first, early modernity. I made this warning several times last year, it's worth it to revisit it now, that periodization, this urge to break history into neat periods in order to facilitate understanding, is a useful tool. It does actually work that way to help you understand things. The only problem is it's just a gross falsehood when applied to the reality of history. Right? First of all, of course, time doesn't have periods. Nobody ever woke up in the morning and said, oh, thank God, modernity. Right? The time is a continuity. Right? And because of that is the second piece, which is that there will be ways in which you are in the early modern, there'll be ways in which you're still in the medieval. Right? Probably the best known example is the Renaissance. The Renaissance appears in thought before it appears in art. Right? In architecture, it'll appear at different times. That's just in time. Geography, Italy will be in the Renaissance, you know, at a certain point. France and Germany will join the party, etc. Right? And there may be people who never enter the Renaissance at all. Famously, the Jews of the Pale of Settlement, if you're familiar with that sort of borderland between, you know, Poland, Ukraine, Russia, depending on what year, will largely stay in the Middle Ages right up until the 20th century, many of them. And some actually carry it about with them now, right? So meaning these are useful frames of thought, but don't give them too much sense of absolute reality. Nevertheless, it's important. Oh, the last thing, of course, is there's no breaking up history into periods without some value judgment behind it, right? Because somebody at some point decided that's medieval and this is modern, and I'll leave it to you, which you'd like to be called. Right? We'll get into it maybe if we get to the Romantic period, although my suspicion is that'll be next year. But if people are familiar a bit with the history, the intellectual history, it's in the Romantic period that the Middle Ages made a comeback. The Enlightenment saw classical Greco-Roman culture as its sort of ideal. And then the Romantic period redeemed the Middle Ages in many ways. And so there's a strange, and that has more to do with the historians who are living either in the Enlightenment and in the Romantic period than it has to do with the medieval or modern period or, you know, sort of late antiquity on its own. So it's just a warning. Nevertheless, I want to speak about early modernity, and if we're going to give it at least a time frame, we're going to say for the Jewish story from 1492 to, we'll just say right now, the 18th century. I don't want to get into it too hard and fast an end date because it's not possible. And 1492 is just a gift to historians. Like, so many things happened. Like I told you guys last week, the expulsion from Spain, Columbus's crossing of the ocean, which marks for European culture the encounter with the New World, right? The fall of Al-Andalus, of the last Muslim stronghold at that time in continental, at least Western, we'll call it Western Europe. And therefore, the Reconquista, the consolidation of Christian society within the Iberian Peninsula. All those things happen more or less at the same time, which will begin a new era. But there are going to be, and if you're curious, this is in the footsteps of Professor David Ruderman, there are going to be five key points that we're going to want to pay attention to, and since I'm conveniently located in front of a whiteboard, maybe I'll at least write the headings up there. Number one, the knowledge explosion. You know, it used to be that censorship was done through the control of knowledge. I mean, most of world history, most people were illiterate. So therefore, their access to knowledge beyond direct communication was very limited. Right? Famously, the Catholic Church fought the translation of the Latin Bible into the vernacular for hundreds of years for various reasons, not the least of which is that if you could read it, you might actually disagree with what the priest has to say. Right? They should have spoken to the Jews about that. Right? But you know what? Today, of course, that is not our issue. That's not how censorship is done. Anybody know how censorship works today? Distraction. Right? In a world of information, distraction is the way in which you censor people's minds. I want you to pay attention to that as you read the news or indulge in various things. Oh, I'm supposed to, this is, he's supposed to be having me doing this. Oh, well, it ain't happening. That happens too. But for our purposes at this point in early modernity, number one tool of knowledge explosion around about the mid-15th century, anybody? The printing press, of course, right? Because the very price of books plummeting, their availability rising, fitting into many currents that we'll trace going forward, not the least of which, the creation of a national consciousness. Once you have a vernacular literature, right? Printers play a very important role in homogenizing various European languages. German's the best documented example that you know, the various German states spoke dialects of German, which were intelligible to one another, but they weren't necessarily the same. But if I'm going to print a book, it's got to be in one language. And it was actually Martin Luther who prints the Lutheran Bible, right, in mid-16th century, right, who is, you know, sort of colloquially known as the first best-selling author in European history. Right, because he's the first person whose personality drove the sales of his book. It wasn't his book, it was God's book. But it was his translation. And my point is that what he also did was he created a common language for Germans. It was a lot of what pushed the rise of modern German into usage. Right, so the printing press has played a very important role, and we will trace its impacts in many ways. Fast on the heels of that printing press is the democratization of knowledge. Right, in the Jewish story, who were historically the masters of knowledge? The rabbinic class, no question, right? And they go hand in hand with the scribal class, not just, of course, in terms of the Torah and the scribal class that still exists today, but anybody here ever get to go to the National Museum, National Library here, and see some of the folio volumes, like manuscripts of like the Rambam and other things? It's fantastic. And you know what you get a sense of every time you see a book like that? The weight of the written word. It takes a lot of intentionality to write folio volumes. Big, heavy work. Not only that, you know what else takes? A lot of time, and therefore a lot of money. Meaning somebody's got to be bankrolling it. But the reality is once movable print gets online, and it's one of the best ways, by the way, just to trace the social context of technological advance. Right? It begins as a relatively crude process, but finds a quick market, which funnels resources back into the process, and then enterprising people realize, like, you know, some of the first big printers of Jewish books weren't Jews. And they weren't even necessarily sort of Christians. Yeah, it died. They weren't even necessarily Christians who were enthusiastic about the Jews. You know what they were? Early entrepreneurs and capitalists. Jews would buy the books. Right? It's the same reason when I asked my brother who writes for the New York Times, why the Times writes so much about the Jews. Forget the Israel thing. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going into politics. This is why I like to teach early modernity, right? But you know what his answer was? Why it's always so obsessed about the Jews? Who do you think reads newspapers? that was his answer, and that hasn't changed. So this democratization of knowledge allowed very different people to get their opinions out there. You understand? It's not just the fact that the printing increased access. It also increased or decreased the level of the gatekeeper, right? And I think I might have made this joke last year, but you have to remember, a culture which reveres the printed word, right? anybody here ever kiss a prayer book or another safer when it fell to the ground, right? But you haven't lived until you've seen your five-year-old pick up the Cat in the Hat when it falls down and kiss it. Because that's what happens when you have a culture which has been trained to revere the written word, which encounters cheap print technology. Now, that sounds funny, but I want you to appreciate what happens then when some guy without the weight of rabbinic authority or even the weight of rabbinic learning, without a commitment to the social structure, all those things were necessary to marshal the resources in order to actually have scribes write out your book. No, he's just some guy with some pennies in his pocket and some crazy ideas who finds a printer who's willing to do a quick run of his four-sheet pamphlet, and you know what he starts to do? Sell it, hawk it on the streets. But along comes some Jew and sees the printed word and reads it and assumes what? It must be, have weight. It must be, it's in print. Right? I mean, just like people say today, well, they said it on the news. It must be true. Right? So that's going to have a big impact. As we're going to see, that will play a very big role going forward in the story of the Sabbatean movement, which we touched last year, but we will come back to. But wait, but that's, again, knowledge explosion. Printing press, democratization of knowledge, as a subset will be a rise of what we know as the Christian Hebraeus. The Hebrew language, since antiquity, has largely been the possession of who? The Jews. Yeah, and not even all the Jews. Really, it's an intellectual caste amongst the Jews, although there's a lot of pushback against the Zionist narrative, you should know, that Hebrew was a dead language that Eliezer ben Yehuda revived into the vernaculars. It is a classic element of the what's called Shlilat HaGalut, the Zionist desire to negate any significance to exile, because the reality is Hebrew was alive and well in pockets and in, you know, like substrata of societies. Eliezer ben Yehuda did succeed in creating a vernacular dictionary. I don't want to dismiss that, but you know, I always want to be wary of the agendas there. But what's interesting about our period, and we'll touch on it, if not at the end of today, then the beginning of next week, is there amongst Christians will be a renewed interest in the Hebrew language, which will go hand in hand with the Renaissance, which is one of the great cultural movements of early modernity. You know, the Renaissance, most people associate with what cultures? Greco-Roman, right? Classical European cultures. But don't forget that Greek and Latin have a sister classical language, Hebrew. And particularly because it will be the humanists from within the Catholic Church who really begin the Renaissance culturally, not necessarily in art, it's ever in thought, their first go-to will be the question, hey, can I trust this Vulgate? Vulgate is the Latin translation of the Bible made by Jerome in the, I think, 2nd century? Quote me on that, though. 1st or 2nd century. I can't remember exactly one right now. So they have a Latin Vulgate, and the question arises, is it accurate? Is it truly reflective of the spirit of the text, which is a classic humanist question? And so therefore, and I'm just painting the picture now, we will come to them in more specifics, this part of this knowledge explosion will also produce the cultural interface between Christianity and Hebrew. The Christian Hebraeus, right, will take what we call today cultural appropriation, will take a lot of the mystic knowledge in particular that's bubbling up amongst Am Yisrael because they finally gained enough mastery of the Hebrew language to access the texts. It's a fascinating phenomenon. Again, also goes with the democratization of knowledge. Big important rabbis weren't about to share their Talmud with the Christian monks, but the printer who prints them might. Yeah, why not? If the monk wants to pay me money, he can read the Talmud, right? So there's a lot of texture that. So number one, the knowledge explosion. Number two, mobility. On one level, kipshuto, in its simple sense, right? This is the great age of exploration, which, I don't know about you guys, but I find like one of the most romantic notions, not romantic like love, though, just like, I mean, what would possess a person to get on a chunk of wood and sail off into the ocean when most of the world is telling you you're going to get to the edge and fall off, right? Fantastic voyages. I love reading the stories of these times, but just remember that this is the great age of exploration, therefore mobility will be the hallmark. It's going to play a very important role in seeing how the exiles from Spain literally get scattered to the four corners of the world. And just to give you an important parallel to mobility is this, there's a economic driver to mobility at this era, which has probably always been true. Columbus wasn't, he wasn't doing pure science. He was looking for gold. And in fact, I have in my notes here, it's a great essay that I read recently, that Columbus's diary mentions gold 114 times and God only 26. Just to give you a sense of scale, right? And the whole driver for the crossing, just to put some piece out, Columbus sails the Ocean Blue 1492, right? Two other important dates just to keep in your mind is 1494. Anybody remember their European history? Excellent. The Treaty of Tordesillas. Yeah, very nice. This guy teaches history, though. That's not fair. The Treaty of Tordesillas, which is when the Pope, in hopes to prevent World War Zero, I guess that would be, between Spain and Portugal, divides the globe along a longitude line, which it cuts through Brazil, which is, by the way, why they speak Portuguese in Brazil and not Spanish, right? And the Spanish basically say, we'll go west. The Portuguese say, we'll go east, and they split the world. Which just, yeah, it's so interesting. But just, first of all, contemplate the hubris here. The Pope sees fit to divide the world, meaning he's in charge of the world, between Spain and Portugal, who see fit to submit their claims to the world for his adjudication. That's not going to play out well for everybody who they find in all those countries they're going to conquer. Right? Especially not because in the end of the day, there's a story. I highly encourage you guys to read a book called Debt, The First 5,000 Years by David Graeber. He's a Harvard anthropologist. Debt. Since somebody's going to ask, I'll write it up. The first 5,000 years. David, I think Graeber, but you might want to check that spelling. It's a fantastic look on the role that debt plays in driving human progress. He was deeply involved in the World Trade Organization protests and the Occupy movement in New York as one of the intellectual sort of architects of the whole thing, Jew that he is. But my point in bringing it up, what's that? Oh. My point in bringing it up, we might want to close that door because it's going to get loud in a second, is that this is not just the great age of exploration, it's also the great age of exploitation. And I want you to keep that in mind because the Jews are going to fit very well into what is now the mercantilist system. For those of you who remember your European history, we'll talk more about that, don't worry. Right? And will eventually become the capitalist system because this is the point at which the Jews finally are able to fully leverage our role as an international people. Thinking back to last year, or a time period that we haven't got to learn together yet, depending on who is together, the Jews played this role last in history when? You didn't want to answer, you wanted to ask something. What did you want to ask? Go ahead and ask, Peter. Yes. So I don't go too much backwards in time. There is a whole Megillah around Columbus and the Jews. Financed by the, what? Well, wait, hang on. I'll just answer, and then we'll come back to, right, but actually it's later in the Roman Empire, so I'll give you a second shot. But the Columbus's whole expedition was largely financed by the new Christians, by the conversos, right? And it's arguable as part of a larger hope to get out of town. And we're going to speak about that at a later time when there was actually a full-blown, what we Americans at least would call underground railroad, to get conversos out from under the rule of the Inquisition. We'll speak about that in the person of Doña Gracia, the Mendez, probably next to Queen Esther, most famous woman in Jewish history. But we'll tell her story. It's going to take a little while because she isn't bound in 1550. But okay, I don't know your name. Ellie, I'll give you a second shot. Roman Empire, also the Jews played an important role, although less so. When was the last time Jews played the international merchant role? Yeah, Middle Ages before what?
The Sultan.
Well, between the Crusades.
Before the fall of the
Moors. Right, basically the Middle Ages, what's called the High Middle Ages, right? The Jews played the role between the Christian and Muslim world, right? So let's say the 9th century through to 12th or 11th, it begins to break down in the Crusades because the Crusaders actually plant themselves in the heart of the Muslim world and are able to control the trade routes. That then, if you're familiar, it's the rise of the Italian city-states where they basically take over the trade. But the Jews are going to make a very strong comeback in this great age of exploration and exploitation. And it's not always going to leave the best taste in people's mouths. And we're going to want to keep that in mind, is the role in which the Jew fits the economic system in early modernity is going to set a lot of the molds for how the Jew is perceived within the larger social system, which was true in the Middle Ages as well. In the Middle Ages, the Jew was at least perceived to be the usurious money lender, right? Largely because they were forced into that role. In the great age of exploration, most Jews are not going to be what are called port Jews, these sort of very important merchants who play a role. We'll have a whole class on port Jews, but they will fit the economic system in ways that will create a perception of the Jews.
But they were also the navigators.
They were more often the scientists behind the navigators. Avram Zacuto, whose story we'll tell, actually creates many of the charts that allowed the Portuguese and the Spanish, yes, to cross the oceans and round the globe. So,
help them understand mobility on the seas, let's say, in the age of exploration, as opposed to, say, like the Vikings, they were on the seas, you know, I don't know, like they're doing Caesar's time. You know, there was mobility on the seas, but help me understand.
What's changed? Great. Two things I would say. The technology has advanced. I mean, the Vikings were rowing longboats, and they simply didn't have the reach. Whereas sailing technology at this point is making leaps and bounds and allows, therefore, for the economics to be dependent upon. The Vikings would go conquer and colonize. The Portuguese are going to create a system of economic exploitation. It's worth it to go to South America, create a mine, and which is based on the idea of bringing all the silver back to Portugal or Spain. Right? You guys remember the mercantile system? Then what would they do? All the people that were living in South America needed what?
Goods.
Where would they purchase those goods from? Portugal and Spain. And so like everything, this is the classic model of mercantile colonization. So that's one thing. But that's dependent upon a reliable technology that can cross the Atlantic. Right? Absolutely. This is the beginning of the whole imperial progress. I mean, the second wave, because Rome was the first, and the Jews had a hand in that as well. But the other piece is the rounding of the globe and the perception that there was one world. It's a very big deal. Like the idea that once, because the other, we had 1492 with Columbus, we got 1494 with the Treaty of Tordesillas, which sets the political mold, and then you have Vasco da Gama, who's the first person to round the Horn of Africa and realize you can get from Europe to India in a relatively safe, if not speedy, route, right? And it just opens up for Europe a whole new horizon of exploration and therefore exploitation. And the Jews are always, I want you to picture the exile from Spain as if you had a pile of Jews on this table and someone went, wham! And they went, phew. A lot of them got destroyed, but the ones who drifted off will land literally everywhere. And like I said, over the next several classes, we're going to try to at least put a finger on the various places that they do. Okay.
One last thing.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the 15th century, late 15th, early 15th century. Right? This is the age in which, and the Jews are deeply involved in the redrawing of those maps, as you pointed out. But I want to point out, we're not just talking about physical mobility. We're also about cultural mobility, right? This is a point at which many different types of Jews are going to be brought together. There's a fairly well-publicized tshuva, response of the Radbaz. The Radbaz was Rav David ibn Zimri, was the leader of Cairo's Jewish community in the 16th century. How many pauses can I make in one sentence, right? And Radbaz, very productive. We'll come back to his story a little bit when we talk about the Arizal, the famous mystic of Sfat. But for our purposes, he has a tshuva where someone asked him, how do they deal with the influx of Spanish Jews coming into Cairo? Right? And particularly the fact that the Spanish held themselves as the nobility of the Jewish people, which is all well and good when you're amongst the nobility, but when you're amongst the commoners, you might make a poor impression. Right? So they would show up in these places, and what we see is the Sephardization. Today you talk about being Ashkenazic or Ashkenormic, how do you say it? That everything's Ashkenazi-centered in the Jewish world today, people are complaining. Well, once upon a time, in many of these places, it became Sephardic-centered. This is where the misnomer that labels Jews from Egypt or Syria or Yemen Sephardim. Remember, Sfarad in Hebrew is where? Spain, right? That's why today the term which is more sort of popular use is Edota Mizrach, the communities of the East, which even then is like already edgy because like East, West, what? But what's happening is that these Jews who have a rich tradition of learning, also a deep knowledge of communal organization, so they know how to move in, set up, take over, and the assumption that they're always right, right, will land in many of these communities, and this cultural mobility will not always be positive. So the Radbaz's tshuva actually says, the person's asking him, wait, are they allowed to set up their own community? Like the Sephardim came in, took over, and this guy wants to know whether the locals can withdraw from what had been the communal organization and set up their own synagogue. And he gives the answer he gives, which is actually very beautiful. He says that basically, if I weren't sort of hesitant to give you this advice, I would tell you a person should never pray with anyone who they can't look in the face of and feel love for. Which is a very beautiful, yeah, we're all going to be alone in shul. No, sorry. It was worth the laugh, though, come on. But my point is that there, this cultural mobility, on one hand, will create all kinds of mix and fantastic new productivity. On the other hand, there's a lot of like hard, like, hey, you don't look Jewish, right? I mean, just think about it. When these guys showed up in the Ottoman Empire wearing capes, it's like, what are you doing? You know, like, that's a very hard encounter, which will have a lot of consequences going forward. But in the end of the day, by the way, the Sephardic, meaning classic Spanish Jewish culture, will win almost universally, with the interesting exception of Italy. Yeah, the interesting exception of Italy, which is part of the story that we're going to touch a little bit today. Okay, and of course, new mobility between Jew and non-Jew. A lot of encounters with Jews. I already mentioned the Christian Hebraeus, and there's going to be a lot of that in our story going forward. Early modernity will offer new molds of interaction that the Middle Ages, which could often be think of as like a set drama by this point, like it's like there are certain modes at least in which the Jew and non-Jew interacted, which were not all negative, but they were like classic modes. Now early modernity will offer whole new models, which again, basically it's either going to be the sort of frothing possibility that encounter always offers, right? How many of you guys love to travel, right? There's different types of people. Some love to travel, some not. And one of the reasons that people love to travel is because encountering new things brings new things out in yourself. And you could never be who you are if you don't encounter things which you don't know what they are. Right? The other thing that happens is that what happens oftentimes when we encounter new things? We shut down. Because there will be a reactionary conservatism that occurs because of this mobility as well. Right? And that's going to actually sort of have a deep impact on early modernities. The rabbinic class is going to be thinking very quickly, how do we hold things together in a world of increased mobility? It used to be that literally everybody was born, lived, and died. Not everybody, but most people were born, lived, and died in the same place. Now suddenly people are moving around, lots of possibilities, but lots of problems as well. Third piece, rising communal cohesion. right? The great structures. I mean, today the idea of like Jews and community organization goes hand in hand in most of our minds, right? I mean, the Americans in the crowd, depending on when and where you grew up, may have actually had their foundational relationship to Judaism to be organizational Judaism, meaning it's not necessarily content oriented. That Jews are because they organize. That's a big part of the history of, no, I'm being facetious, but that's a big part of the history of American Judaism, right? It was known as campaign Judaism, like the federations and how do you get people organized. And then suddenly at some point around about the 70s, people started to wake up and say, well, where's the content? God, forget, because they haven't even started to talk about God, just content. We're trying to push text right now because God comes in through the cracks. So the rise of communal cohesion is a very interesting story. Just going to put our finger on it right now, because the key is those two pieces. One, we have to ask a question. How much is this related to the rise of the nation state? The nation state, meaning the one of the hallmarks of modernity, is the political organization we know as the nation state, which we're just going to leave undefined for right now because that will come. But as opposed to the kingdom or the empire or the just sort of lawless open lands as the Europeans see them. The nation state is a very specific form of political organization, and one of its hallmarks is centralization. So how much will the rise of communal cohesion and large-scale Jewish communal organizations, the archetype of which, if you're familiar with it, is what's known as the Council of the Four Lands in Eastern European Jewry, right? But how much of that is a product of or a parallel to the increasing cohesion of political entities in modernity. That we want to keep an eye on, right? The other piece is really part of the next, which is the crisis of rabbinic authority. In its full sense, but all of the elements that make up the nation state really come into being when Ferdinand and Isabella unite the Iberian Peninsula. And there is a strong argument to be made that even though it's a kingdom and not a nation state, but the first proto nation state of European history is Spain. In terms of the centralization, the elevation of absolute authority, right, the unification and homogenization of law, all the things that the concept of a homogenous citizenry, which of course is why you get rid of the Jews and the Moors. So you're correct. Classically, it's a product of the 19th century, but its roots are in our storyline, early modernity. And, you know, processes take a long time to bear fruit. Bismarck, the whole blood and iron policy is the mid to late 19th century. 1870 is the Franco-Prussian War. So anyway, that, God willing, will come to, but probably next year. You got to slow history down, otherwise I'm run out of a job at some point. So the crisis of rabbinic authority, rabbis are always in crisis. Have you noticed this? It's just like it has been since now. I mean, rabbis weren't in crisis in the medieval era. They were on top, right? And the rabbinic class has been basically the arc from let's call it the time of the Mishnah all the way through the Middle Ages with bumps and starts and side fits. I don't want to oversimplify, but it has been a rise of the rabbinic class as the both religious and political leadership of the Jewish people. Who is going to make the big play to challenge rabbinic authority in early modernity? Middle classes don't really come online yet in any significant sense, but you're going in the right direction. And scholars are the rabbis. That will be the secular scholars. So that will be 19th century. Money. The merchants. And we will look at this in large extent. And one of the nice things about the documents is that this is also the point, because of the nature of communal cohesion, that communities start to keep journals of their community. So we can see what were the communal sort of political and social structures. And one of the hallmarks of this period, particularly amongst, I heard somebody name the converso communities, particularly amongst not so much the conversos, but what's known as the nacio, the Portuguese Hebrew nation that we'll introduce today, the people with money believed in the golden rule, right? He who has the gold rules, right? So what happens is the beginning of the rabbinic crisis of authority is the professionalization of the rabbinic class, which may sound odd. But let's remember, through most of the Middle Ages, rabbi was not a paid position. On the contrary, if you look through the Talmud and much of medieval rabbinic literature, you'll see that it's deeply frowned upon to take money to serve in a religious or even perhaps educational capacity. Right? What happens is basically the end of the Middle Ages is rough for Am Yisrael. It's really rough. If you guys remember last year, we spoke about the 100 years of misery that pushed Western European Jewry progressively eastward. We're going to come back to that story probably in another month or two once we finish talking about the scattering of the exiles. But there, round about the late 14th, early 15th century, we get the first evidence that because it's become so hard to survive, and because they want to preserve a knowledge class, it's become permissible to pay a rabbi to officiate as the sort of decisor of halachic legal questions, and also as the sort of religious authority. Becomes permissible to pay them. The same thing comes out of the last 100 years or so of destruction that precede the expulsion from Spain, to the point where by the time we get to early modernity, this is a profession. You get paid to do it. And when you get paid to do it, you know what happens if you don't do your job? You get fired. And you know who gets to make the parameters of your job? The folks that pay you. That's right. That's how it works. Now, it's not, again, we're not oversimplify, because, of course, there will be also still the authority vested in the masters of knowledge and tradition, right? Your point about the 19th century is when that part will go, you know? But for now, we're still dealing, by and large, almost universally with Jews who revere rabbinic authority as a thing unto itself. They just wanted to keep it in its proper place, right? And when it comes to, like, an example, the merchants of the city of Leghorn in Italy, which is a very important Jewish community, merchant community, one of the only Jewish communities in Italy that actually wasn't ghettoized. You can look at their communal takanon. How do you say that? Communal ordinance. Excellent. Thank you so much for that. The communal ordinances, and they say basically the rabbi has the authority to adjudicate all questions of religious law. All questions of commercial law are subject to the law of the marketplace, basically without his interference. And the merchants basically said, rabbi, you're more than welcome to tell people how to cook the chicken, or when to get married, or etc. But don't tell us how to do business, because that's part of the world, right? Leghorn, L-E-G-H-O-R-N. It has another name in Italian, Liverno, yeah. I just like it because I think of Foghorn, Leghorn, it makes me smile. Anybody who got the joke can talk to me later. Okay, so again, this rapidly expanding world, the exposure of the cultural melange, so like you could find religious Jews who do things otherwise, which casts doubt upon the rabbi's absolute comprehension and therefore authority over what the Torah dictates. The theological crisis which comes in the wake of Spain, which we'll speak about today, we're headed toward that now, which is going to deeply undermine, in strange ways, rabbinic authority, because the messianism which will come in its wake the rabbis are a conservative class, small c, right? They want to keep things even and steady, etc., lot. And whereas the messianism which will arise in response to the crisis of the expulsion is ready to break what we call Shvirat HaKelim. It wants to break through. That's going to have a challenge. And last but certainly not least, the rise of individuality. You know, sort of amongst secular historians, the rise of individuality, individual identity, as opposed to, right, I'm a Jew, I'm a German, I'm a Christian. No, I'm me. That rise of individuality, which is one of the hallmarks of modernity, will challenge all authority. I mean, to the point today where we're in the postmodern era, right, my personal identification trumps my biology in our society. It's a matter of argument, but it's beyond argument that there are people for whom that's true, right? I mean, approve, disapprove is like irrelevant to me right now, right? It's a reality. You understand that there's an arc there, that I free myself from the communal identity, and then I free myself even from religious, national, ultimately free myself even from what were classically the inviolate physical boundaries of identity. Question of where it's going is his own question, but here, the rabbinic structure is a communal structure. So therefore, this is a big part of the crisis. Slowly but surely. Last, but certainly not least, is the breakdown, which we spoke about last week, so I'm not going to, do too much of a roux, of the us and them identity. Breakdown of us and them identity. Right? One of the nice things about the Middle Ages is everybody knew who they were. Right? You're a Jew, you're a Christian. And that was the big one for our question. Right, you're a knight, you're a serf. You're right. And so many of the forces of early modernity as a whole begin to erode the feudal structure that gave people a collective identity, but it also begins, in particular amongst the conversos, to erode the religious clarity that came with I'm a Jew or a Christian. Right? I touched on this last week in this sense of how could it be that someone who lives their life as a Catholic monk identifies as part of the Hebrew nation of the Portuguese, right? And what we'll see is going forward is that when you set that monk free, you get him out of the Iberian Peninsula through your Underground Railroad, you settle him in Amsterdam, which is a classic destination, as we'll see, and you give him the freedom to practice a Jew, and he says, yes, thank God I'm a Jew. You know what he encounters? The strictures of rabbinic identity. Well, his whole identity up till now have been based on this inner commitment and identification and rebellion against the structure around him. He gets out, and what he encounters? A new, very restrictive structure. Personalities that thrive on rebelling against the structure around them aren't going to do so well in classic rabbinic Judaism. Trust me, I've tried to build yeshivas out of them. Yeah. We will speak about the conversos at length. So I want to just leave that as an image for now and as another one of the hallmarks of early modernity for our story, and that's it. Not to say, I'm sure there's more, but I want you to understand that these are what I like to think of as the topography on which our story is going to play out. Right? Each person or each group of people that we're going to follow down the line of history is consciously or not going to be walking on this topography. Right? And as you guys probably know, if anybody's ever done any backcountry travel, you may want to get from point A to point B. But the one thing you can't negotiate is with topography. You can go over the ridge or you can go around it. You ain't going through. Right? And so this will, in many ways, confine and direct the power of the story that we're going to tell. Questions or comments on this definition of early modernity, contingent as it may be? And if people are curious, I can point you toward Professor David Ruderman, who, like I said, I'm taking a lot of this from his thought. He's one of the important historians of Jewish thought today.
These are the things from the Jewish perspective that were happening at this time.
Yes.
At a different time.
Yes.
You said 2 days before. One was the Pope, the other one was Vasco da Gama?
Yes.
Okay. So you
should
hear that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, I think it's doing an injustice to history by reducing it to five. I don't think it can be reduced further, but if I were going to point to, let's say, something which these all share, it's mobility, right? Meaning the level of connectivity and the ease of motion between modes of thought, modes of culture, points of geography, right, places of authority. So I would say it would be mobility is the one thing that runs through them all. Other what? Yes, but this is a different characteristic, and I want to start to tell the stories now because, again, this is the danger of of giving like too much of an overarching picture is that sometimes stories are best told through particular narratives. So just if there's anything people don't understand before we get going, it's important because I do want to have a somewhat unified conversation. Yep. True.
Yeah.
Yep.
This
it seems to be a sticking force.
That's a very unique yep.
Yep. Well, why they should know that Professor Rudiman's a little skeptical about this one. He suggests it because it is one of the hallmarks. He's not sure about where it comes from, and we'll just keep our eye out. This is a working definition. We're not bound by it. Okay, you guys ready? So the first story that I really want to follow, like I said, is the story of the Jews scattered from Spain. The scale of the crisis, as we mentioned last week, is kind of hard for us to imagine, though, sadly, in our day, we do have a parallel, which is, of course, the destruction of a third of world Jewry in Europe. And one of the things which, to this very day, has not been dealt with, people, is how do you respond to such a crisis in a constructive fashion? One of the real ironic tragedies, fill in your word that you want, of the rise of the State of Israel coming so swiftly on the heels of the Holocaust is it allowed Am Yisrael, much of Am Yisrael at least, to sidestep the issue. It was like, whew, well, that was good, we made it. And that's why if you've ever been to Yad Vashem, it's physically oriented to deliver that message. It ends looking out at the hills, which is like the only way you could possibly bear what you just saw is this. And I'm not saying that's not true, or I'm not saying that it is. My point is that that option wasn't available in 1492. And so I think there's a lot to be learned, aside from the fact that I love history and it's fun to learn about the past, but I've told you guys before that I'm not actually interested in the past on its own. I'm interested in how it can help us be who we want to be in the future. And so therefore, I think there's a lot to be learned from the various ways in which the exiles from Spain were able to integrate into their both selfhood and their culture what was at the time seen to be a unique tragedy. We're going to come back to that perception of uniqueness momentarily. But in general, the two paths that I want to sort of pursue going forward are what I would call messianism and a universalist-tinged pragmatism. What do I mean? Messianism, we know, and we've spoken about it many times. I encourage, and if people want, they can send me an email. I'm happy to share the essay with you that Professor Gershom Scholem has a history of Jewish messianism. Very powerful essay, not gonna drag you through it right now, but one of the things that he points out is that messianism is nothing new in Jewish tradition, right? I mean, it's almost built in. Not so clear that it's there in biblical text, even though our later tradition will strive to read it in, but certainly it is one of the major ways in which exile has been assimilated, pun intended, into Jewish consciousness, right? Which is that exile is defined by the belief that I belong somewhere else. Well, that's awfully depressing if I am in exile because the world's strongest empire, Rome, or at the time, Spain, has driven me there, because how on earth am I ever going to get back? And by the way, the exiles from Spain will often see themselves as an exile from where? Now that's the confusion. They were in exile from Jerusalem while they were in Spain, but now that they're kicked out of Spain, are they in exiles from Jerusalem or are they exiles from Spain? Right? So we'll hold that thought. But the messianic element adds hope, points out Professor Scholem. That's hope because the reality is I can't imagine in my rational mind how I would ever get back to Jerusalem in the 15th century. But I have hope. I'm going to wait. I'll pray. It's going to happen. How? I don't know. So long as my daily life remains at a threshold of tolerance, survivability, and even thriving, hope's an important element. Always remember that, right? Hope is the most precious commodity. If you can offer it to someone, do so. But, I'll get you both in 1 second, please. But what happens to hope when life gets desperate is it gets desperate as well. And that's when hope becomes messianic fervor. Right? In the sense that, okay, listen, life is rough. It's hard to be a Jew, but we're getting by. And don't worry, because someday it's going to be better. That attitude actually is what allows us to be sitting in this room today. Right? But the other part is what happens when actually it's not okay. And when life isn't tolerable. Right? But you still have the sense, but the story's supposed to go somewhere. You know what happens? It has to be now. That's the difference between hope and fervor. It has to be now, right? Like I've said to many of my Chabadnik friends, I'm all into the Messiah. It doesn't have to be Mashiach now. I've said to many of my peace-loving friends, I'm very into Shalom. But why does it have to be Shalom Achshav, right? Meaning, no, I'm not dismissing that, but just notice that there's a very powerful and dangerous element when hope turns to fervor, right? By the way, it's powerful. The Zionists had a feeling it has to be now. And if you read, like, particularly like Ben-Gurion and the other political leaders of the Yishuv, you know, in the sort of early, like the 30s, they realized, like, it's now or never. And you know what? They made decisions based on a now or never attitude, and they got more than they could ever dreamed of. So it's a gamble. But that messianism is going to be one of the ways in which the Jews who scattered from Spain will try to assimilate what is seen to be the biggest tragedy since the destruction of the Second Temple, which is, it must be now. It must be now, and that will be a very big part of the momentum. Okay, I ask you guys to wait. One.
I just think it's interesting that today, in 2019, there are many on the scene who sing songs about how much they yearn for Spain.
Yes. Yeah, and I want to come back to that, this sense that their identity is Spanish. Right, and that the generations later of forced converts are holding on to the Spanish side of their identity is going to become a very important part of the other story of early modernity.
I'm not sure about the hope. The hope is a Jew. Hope is a non-Jew.
No, we're talking about the Jews right now. I mean, look, it's true for Jew and non-Jew that hope is one of the most precious commodities. I mean, we see this today. The sort of like despair around climate is not a positive in my eyes. The concern, I happen to be a committed environmentalist, the concern, the awakening, great. Despair never served anybody except evil. Because when people despair, they become putty in the hands of the angriest, loudest voice around. But hope is a sense of, you know, I don't understand exactly how. Because remember, hope is dealing with the irrational. And that's what I'm trying to get across here. Hope by nature deals with the rational. Because if I have a rational analysis, you know, if I went to my financial planner, which I don't have, but if I had one, right? If anyone got to give me $several million, I'm happy to hire a financial planner and have the following conversation. And I went to him and I said, what does the market, you know, look like? I'm in very stable, I don't know, government bonds or whatever. And I say, how much money can I expect to have at the end of this year? He's not going to say to me, well, you know, I'm hoping for. First, he's going to say, this is the rational analysis, even though there's always a lot of uncertainty there. And I say, well, what if I took a higher risk yield? You know, I went in for, I don't know anything about these things. I don't know, stocks, whatever it was that's a higher, I'm in education, I don't know anything about these things. Whatever, a higher risk investments. Then he's going to start to say to me, what? Well, you know, we can hope that we could make this percentage. Why? Because the risk is what is based on uncertainty, right? Hope is the way, one of the ways in which we manage uncertainty, right? And so therefore, it is a very important survival tool. Yes?
Can you give us an idea what the numbers
of Jews were? I thought you were gonna ask me about percentage. That is a great question, how many Jews were actually involved in the expulsion? It's a great question, which is a source of tremendous controversy. Because if you look at what we're going to mention momentarily, the historiography around the expulsion, the numbers are quite high, in the hundreds of thousands. But one of the professional historians who really began to shift the perception of that was his first name I think is Yosef Baer, Professor Baer, who wrote a 2-volume history of the Jews of Christian Spain. Fantastic work of history, actually pretty readable. If anybody wants to borrow it, you can twist my arm and maybe I'll lend it to you. But what he did is he actually went back through the primary documents in tax documents and land leases and the Inquisition. And his argument is that we're talking about a fraction of that in the tens of thousands of Jews that were. Yeah, that's what his claim is. That's his claim. Not everybody agrees with him because, the absence of evidence is not always evidence of absence, meaning just because you don't find the numbers on the tax rolls, there's all kinds of good reasons that people don't want to end up on the tax roll. So hang on. But aside from curiosity, what drove your question? Because I have a sense it's an important question. Yeah, great. Where does the scale come from? If it were 2 million Jews in the 15th century, I can understand. Well, wow, this is definitive. If it's tens of thousands, it's bad, but the expulsion from England happened in 1290. The whole community was wiped out for 300 years. The world was also smaller. Is for sure a big number, and I don't mean to dismiss that. My point was, and I don't know your name, Karen? I think, that Karen, the critical question, because I don't have a good answer for you, although I've spent a lot of time doing the research, the importance of your question is that how does Spain and the expulsion become such a center point for the Jewish narrative? Is it dependent on pure numbers, or is there something else at play? So I want to keep that question up without falling into the endless argument about actual numbers, because I think there's, even without the numbers, a substantial answer to be made. So again, that's also part of the distinction, because there's a claim that there are almost 100,000 Jews that end up in Portugal. We're going to tell their story. We're going to tell their story momentarily. The ones who were left in the peninsula.
Yeah.
No. But here's the key. How does it become such a definitive story, right? Which is really for us one of the critical pieces, because let's remember that there are many expulsions over the last several hundred years. I think 1290 from England, perhaps the most famous. The expulsion from France in 1306, not a small deal, right? And wasn't the only expulsion from France, right? And we could go on and on with it, especially those of us who were in the class last year. We talked about that whole 100 years of misery, right, that broke the back of German Jewry. So I had the Crusades, and why is the expulsion seen to be a definitive moment? Yes. No, but the it's true. They weren't interested in the conversion. But also, one of the things that we spoke about at length last year is that Ashkenazi culture and Iberian, Spanish Jewish culture dealt with the pressure in two very different ways. The Ashkenazim killed their children, or at least created the myth that one should kill their children rather than even accepting forcible conversion. The Spanish, many of them chose conversion. And we spoke about how a lot of it was out of an erosion of belief in religion at all. It wasn't out of a passion for Christianity per se. And that will follow our story. But I want to keep these narratives somewhat clear. So on one hand, we have this messianic way of dealing with, which is that the way of understanding this hammer blow, which is perceived, we don't exactly know why, but as a turning point, as something of a unique nature, is to say, the time has come, right? Perhaps the most powerful articulation of that worldview, which we'll come back to with the mystics, but I'm not going to focus on it so much today, is if people remember Don Yitzchak Abravanel, who was the finance minister to Ferdinand and Isabella, and then during the expulsion chose not to convert, and he left with the wave of Jews who sought refuge in Portugal, whose story we'll pick up momentarily, right? He served the king of Portugal as well, and then was expelled from Portugal, eventually made his way to the Italian city-states and had a whole wandering life. We told his story last year. We might pick up with his son maybe next week. It might be interesting. But he has the classic embodiment of really the sort of messianic view. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, but it comes from his commentary in the Book of Devarim, from the fourth chapter, that he reads, it says in Devarim, like the days of the heavens on the, hang on, here's, he's going through the whole thing, I'm going to drag you all the way through. He's going through the prophecy in Devarim there. And line by line, he's telling you how the world in which you live now, meaning you're his contemporary, is a fulfillment of the prophecy that you will serve other gods, right? Because he's saying is that not only will people believe in these other gods, because before the Barvanel and before the expulsion, plenty of Jews converted. No. In full awareness, he says that they're nothing but wooden stone, which can't hear, see, or smell, and their worship is nothing other than a means of escaping death. He says that is the culmination of the biblical, the Torah's prophecy, that the turning point before the ultimate redemption will be when you come to worship beings of wood and stone. What's his point? Not that you'll fall into avodah zarah in idolatry. He's like, that's been happening all along. You'll be worshiping them knowing that they're nothing other than wood and stone. Why? Because it's the only way you have to save yourself from death. So he said that the conversos and their experience was a fulfillment of the biblical prophecy. That's one whole path of dealing, and we will pursue it not today, but another time. So you guys understand why that's the messianic view, is that what's happening now is insignificant in and of itself. It doesn't matter. What matters is that it is fulfillment of words said to Moshe at Sinai. Right? And so therefore, once you finish the story, which was told when? 3,000 years ago. Then we can finally move forward. But until that happens, the events of today have no significance in and of themselves. That, you understand why that's the messianic view? And then that will ultimately it will crack, as we'll see, with a messianic activism, which is that there's some necessary ingredient, something we have to do to finish that process and bring about the end. We'll see that story by and by. But that may strike you as a little bit odd. What's the, today we would call it, say, Western secular intellectual counterpoint? If the Abarvanel is looking at the expulsion of the Jews from Spain and explaining it as a fulfillment of the prophecies given to Moshe in the Book of Devarim, what might, I don't know, one of my history professors have said to him? Aside from, you're nuts. He would have said, look for causality. I mean, like, you want to know why the Jews got expelled from Spain? Don't tell me about the Messiah. Don't tell me about your biblical prophecies. Talk to me about socioeconomics. Talk to me about the process of state building. Talk to me about the very unstable relationship between the nobility and the rise of absolute monarchy. Meaning, it's nothing personal, Jew. Or you could even talk to me about the bad blood history between Christianity and Judaism, the necessity of uniting the populace by expelling the foreign element. But don't talk to me about the Messiah. Right? There's another way of looking at the world which is not so prevalent in Jewish thought. But it's fascinating that actually in the 100 years after the expulsion from Spain, there is a brief but potent flowering of what we would call historiography. Right? Historiography is the telling of history, and it is not a common mode of literature in Jewish literature through the ages. Arguably, the last real significant efforts at historiography were in the wake of the destruction of the Second Temple, Josephus, who survives on down through the Middle Ages as Sefer Yosifun. If people are familiar with Sefer Yosifun, which is really a product probably of the 10th century around then, but it is a claims to be the historical Josephus, and it's really a sort of a way to co-opt history in service of the divine plan. That's the distinction I want you to get to understand. Is either the events of today matter in and of themselves? If I want to understand how I got to where I am and where I'm going, I'm going to ask economic, political, social, anthropological, what have you, questions about causality and motivation. Or I'm going to say, no, the events of today don't matter in and of themselves, unless I can analyze them and understand how they are embodiments and fulfillments of prophetic words spoken in the biblical era. This is going to be the split in the way the exiles will integrate such a biblical scale event, which is how they perceived it, into their minds. There was a question somewhere. Yeah, Dove.
The question goes like this, that this idea that this Spanish persecution and conversion was somehow talk about in the Torah. I think this also is somewhat a method of avoiding personal responsibility when you're feeling guilty about it.
Avoiding personal responsibility when you're feeling guilty about it? No, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. Because up until now, we followed a classic rabbinic relationship to history, which is mipnei chataeinu galina me'artzeinu. Because of our sins, we were driven from our land. The parallel to that is that the fathers ate sour grapes and the teeth of the children hurt. You may have heard this rabbinic phrase. There's a sense that, on one hand, we're playing out the past, and we're not responsible. But what's the corollary to the idea that because of our sins, we were driven from our lands? Right. And therefore, our good deeds will allow us to return. So what happens is that history becomes a moral lesson in order to encourage people to keep the Torah and therefore bring about redemption. So I think that from a Western secular standpoint, yeah, it might be a divestment of responsibility. But by the way, that happens in secular history as well. You read economic historians and you will never feel that you have any significance to act in history again. Right, the model, it's called the great man model of history, that Napoleon really mattered, is kind of a dead model amongst many historians. Right, Napoleon was a product of social and economic forces that basically came to focus in him, but he didn't matter in and of himself. The French Revolution was a product of social and economic forces. Robespierre just kind of had to come to be in order to channel them. But the fact that he woke up one morning and set off with their heads, you know, that's not significant. And that there's a danger of being disempowered there as well. So here we have, in the 100 years after the expulsion, which is the time period that I really want to focus on for the next couple weeks, we have these divergent ways of addressing. The majority, I'm just going to tell you now, the majority of Am Yisrael is going to take the mythic approach to understanding the present as a fulfillment of past, right? And we'll see the whole path of the Kabbalah, of Jewish mysticism, which really flowers in this period as a direct response in many ways to that need. But there is, at least in the meantime, a very important, brief though it was, flowering of historiography. I have a list here of 8 authors. There's Shlomo Ibn Virga, who writes the Shevet Yehuda. There's Avraham Zakuto, who was famous for those navigation charts we were speaking about, who writes what's called Sefer Yochasin. There's a bunch. I don't know, there's a reason to just list off. If people want the list, I will happily give it to you. But the key is that out of these 8, 5 of them are either themselves expellees or the descendants of them. And the 6th, Eliyahu Kapsali, was actually deeply influenced by him. He was in Crete when his whole culture was overwhelmed by the Spanish who arrived. This, by the way, Karen, is half an answer to your question. One of the reasons it's perceived as such a big deal is that the only people who wrote history in the wake of it were those who saw it as the central event of their own lives. And therefore, they fit it into a larger narrative, which was then nicely, neatly received. So that's I would say, half the answer. But I want to touch on, well, first we'll round that out, and then I want to tell the story of Shlomo Ibn Virga in the last 20 minutes or so of class. So it's a question that I want to keep on the board for right now, which is, and not answer, meaning, which is that, you know, we spoke last year about the fact that the primary literary response to the Crusades and the types of persecutions in the 100 years before after it was liturgical. There's a whole martyrology, which still exists in Ashkenazi liturgy today. It was a liturgical response. That was like one of the primary literary responses. It's interesting to me that one of the primary literary responses to the expulsion was historiographic. People wanted to try to tell the story. Granted, most of them were not historians in the strict sense. They weren't necessarily looking for the socioeconomic or the causality, et cetera. Many of them were of the messianic history, but they're still trying to tell the story in a way which recognizes that the events which are happening today have significance. That's number one. Number two, there's a shift in scale. Suddenly they start to write about the length from the Second Temple to the expulsion. That becomes like a frame, you know? Like from the Second Temple to the expulsion, implying what? We've shifted somehow. Going back to your question, why was this such a big shift? Also, a renewed interest in non-Jewish history. Like if you think that historically, or let's say it this way, in the past, Jews had dismissed their own history, I mean, what does it matter what's happening now? What matters is what happened then and what will happen later. All we need to do is do Torah and mitzvot. What do I care about the news or your historical analysis? That's how they looked at their own history. So they weren't looking at the history of the kings of Portugal or the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. Suddenly there's like a sense that, whoa, no, these things also matter. Now part of it, again, is the mythic archetypes. You know, Esav and Ishmael are going to struggle, and their final battle is actually the Battle of Gog and Magog, which is, you know, we just came through Sukkot not so long ago, so we got our dose of Gog and Magog in the prophecies of Zechariah and in Yechezkel. And so you could see how that would, the events of our day are simply a playing out of the past. Others are going to ask a very simple question, which is that why would Ferdinand and Isabella kick all the Jews out of their country? Not because he's the embodiment of Esav and Amit. No, he's a king. He has a policy. He's trying to achieve something. And notice that that means I have to somehow take his perspective. This cultural mobility that allows me to say Ferdinand is not just some archetype, some bit player in the Jewish movie who's playing out his role unbeknownst to him, but actually might be an agent unto himself, is going to cause me to look at my own experience very differently. And you know what else? It's looking forward, this one line of path is going to end up with those 19th century intellectuals who start saying, and you know what? There's no Jewish movie. There's only the human movie. And this mistaken need the Jews have to see themselves as something fundamentally different, much less the starring role, has actually been the cause of all of our problems to begin with. Right? And that really, if you're going to look for the origins of that, which is the opposite side of messianism, this is the, let's say, the almost universalist tinged pragmatism. I told you there's two paths. That really we're going to embody in the story of Shlomo Ibn Ezra. Ibn Verga. So who was Shlomo Ibn Verga? He is born in Spain. We don't know exactly when. His early life is a bit of a mystery, but we do know that he was expelled in 1492, along with many of his compatriots. He chose not to convert, which you have to remember that is a very hardened core. Because as we spoke about at length last year, there's the persecutions, the really serious persecutions of the Jews in Spain begins in 1391, which means it's been 100 years of forced conversion, expulsion, Inquisition. And so therefore, anybody at that point who's still willing to now go where, by the way, nobody knows, and you can't take your possessions, and the wolves are swirling around. There are pirates literally waiting offshore for the ships that you will get on, right? So anybody who's willing to do that is a very committed part of the core, right? So he is amongst those who take refuge in Portugal. Because Portugal, I hope people are familiar with the geography, of course, is the only easily accessible land route. The French had expelled the Jews long ago, in 1306. They weren't about to let all the Spanish Jews back in. Plus, you had to cross the Pyrenees. You could go through, you know, Aragon. But so that wasn't an option, which is, by the way, another part of the answer to your question, Karen, is that there was a perception that every other expulsion that had happened in Western European history, you could go somewhere. But now, as Ibn Verga actually says, that there was nothing between us and conversion except the sea, right? And so now, granted, Portugal seemed like a safe spot, but in 1497, the Jews of Portugal were forcibly converted. The brief version of the story is that King Manuel of Portugal, at the end of 1496, as part of his negotiations around marrying the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, whose name was also Isabella, as part of that negotiation, he needed to be more Catholic than the Catholic kings, so he decided that he would impress them by forcibly converting or driving all the Jews out of his country. Originally, it was an edict of expulsion. Okay? They'd all float over into his country from Spain. He was going to give them the boot. He realized that economically, that was a bad idea because he could forcibly convert them and then just soak them for taxes, which is what he actually did in 1497. Because then suddenly, instead of being expelled, Portuguese Jews were prevented from leaving and forcibly baptized and converted to Christianity. Now, this, in truth, is the beginning of the Converso story. Many of the B'nai Anusim today do descend from the ones who went underground in Spain. But in terms of the global converso movement, these people that are going to scatter now all across the globe, who have an inner identification as a Jew and an outer appearance as a Christian, just imagine, these are the people who culturally have survived 100 years of persecution and chose to leave instead of convert at the end. And now you've just done a pro forma forced baptism. You've just created a whole new culture because they're not going to change their inner orientation. They've already proven that, right? But you have the power outwardly to make them act or look Christian. We're going to follow. This is the origin of what's called the Nacio, the Hebrews of the Portuguese nation, which, you know, more or less is a remnant cultural phenomenon today. But in its day was really one of the strongest cultural identities within early modern Judaism. We will see them pop up all over. And what's fascinating is it will consist of rabbis, practicing lay people, people who identify as Christians outwardly, people who identify as Christians inwardly, monks and nuns, people on the peninsula, people in continental Europe, people in the New World. You understand? It is a network, and it calls itself the Nacio. It's its own nation. It's a very strong assertion. But that begins in 1497. Shlomo Ibn Verga was there. The Jews were kept in Portugal until around about 1506. In 1506, there's an awful event in Portuguese history, which is known as the Lisbon Massacre. It's also known as the Easter Slaughter. It's a crazy story that in the São Domingo convent on Easter Sunday, the faithful were praying. There was a terrible drought and plague that was spreading throughout the Iberian Peninsula at the time. The faithful Catholics were together praying, and one of the people in the convent swore that they seen the illuminated face of Jesus of Nazareth on the altar. It was a classic medieval sort of, although these things happen today too, but like a sighting. What happens is some new Christian stands up and says, "Nah, it was just a reflection from the candles." That doesn't end well, right? They literally grabbed him by his hair, dragged him outside, and beat him to death and burned his body. And from there, the pogrom begins, right? And it was joined, apparently, by sailors that were docked in the port. By the end, nearly 2,000 new Christians, meaning Jews who had been recently forcibly in Lisbon, yeah. Lisbon Massacre, 1506. The king and his entourage, and the royal guard, most importantly, were not in town at the time. They'd gotten out of the city to try to avoid the plague. When word of the disturbances might be a better word, right? It reached him. He comes back into town. It's arguable that he might not have gotten involved, but one of his agents who went to investigate was accidentally killed by the mob. Therefore, he brings the royal guard to bear and eventually is able to suppress the looting, right, which was a big part of what was going on. But by the time the smoke clears, nearly 2,000 Jews were killed. And it's actually in the wake of this that the king, for a brief period of time, lifts the travel ban on new Christians from Portugal, and many Jews are able to escape. Amongst them is Shlomo Ibn Verga. So he goes from there, Ibn Verga. Want me to write his name? No. Ibn Gabriel is much earlier. So he travels, and you know, in terms of our mobility, it's sort of a classic example. He goes from there. He seeks refuge first in Italy. He's in Rome, perhaps in Naples. He eventually makes his way to Flanders, like modern day northern Belgium. Antwerp is the port city there, an area which will come back repeatedly in our story in connection with the conversos seeking shelter, and dies in Flanders, likely on his way to the Ottoman Empire. So why do we, on his way, likely trying to get to the Ottoman Empire, because at this point, the Ottoman Empire is the sort of the promised land of the expellees and the conversos trying to escape Christian culture, right? Because since the first expulsion, the sultans have been more than happy to accept the sort of most prosperous and industrious portion of Ferdinand's population that he, for some reason, tries to get rid of, right, as they frame it at the time. Also, Within 10 years, the Ottoman Empire will once again control the land of Israel. And so from the messianic perspective, there's this sense that you know, Ishmael is going to defeat Esav, meaning the Muslims will defeat the Christians, and return Israel to Jerusalem, and there's like this whole narrative going on. So, but the reason I brought up Shlomo Ibn Verga is because he is the author of Shevet Yehuda, the Rod of Judah. It's a biblical reference, which is one of those books that I spoke about. It was part of one of the hallmarks of that flowering of historiography. And one of the reasons that his book deserves our attention, and they all do, but is that his question is, why this enormous wrath? And he sees why this enormous wrath, meaning how does this keep happening? It is a treatment of Jewish history basically from the Second Temple all the way through the expulsion. There's an interesting focus on the blood libel, which we'll touch on at the end here in the brief time remaining to us. But the key is that his question of why this enormous wrath, we all know the answer to it, right? Why is God so angry at the Jews? Because we sinned, right? He'd surely read the Gemara. So apparently that wasn't sufficient. And one of the things which is really lacking from Shevet Yehuda is the whole messianic perspective. This whole idea that the events of his day are embodiments of a biblical prophecy is more or less not present. And so he represents what today, he's not a humanist and he's certainly not an enlightened secular historian. We don't want to overplay it, but he represents a development which is going to be very important in these various ways in which the exiles will deal with this tragedy. Because in endeavoring to solve or answer that question, some of the answers he gives are very interesting, right? He says that the Jews are superior and that this is an expression of God's love. Right, perhaps an uncomfortable theology for people, right? But you can see how it's an inversion in many ways of, because of our sins, we have been exiled from our land. Because at this point, notice, there's no way, it's becoming increasingly difficult to understand what exactly were those sins that we're still suffering for. Right? Now notice, the idea that what are called Yisurim Shel Ava, right, that those who God love, God chastens, right, and tough love, right, God wants us to be the best we can be, so he puts us through all these trials and tribulations, and, you know, the strong survive, that may or may not hold water for you, and that will remain as a current in Jewish thought, right up until when for most people? In the Holocaust. That's just what, I want you to notice, that's obviously where I'm want your mind to go with these questions, that all of the models, including, by the way, the secular, historical, analytical models of why did these things happen, all of them break down at the Holocaust. And we are in a theological vacuum right now, whether you're aware of it or not. The answers, now you can take simplistic answers if that is helpful or meaningful to you. I'm not, you know, but be aware that that's what you're doing. You're ignoring the complexity of the question. So, one answer he gives is that answer, that God, these are Yisurim Shel Ava, God is causing us to suffer out of tough love. But interesting, he also points out, it's also because of our separation from the Christians in matters of food. Yeah, the Jews have this need. Now, he doesn't mean specifically matters of food, but in his culture, remember, in high Spanish Jewish culture, they worked together, they wrote songs together, they shared cultural context. The one place where a believing Jew would draw the line was dinner, right? And so therefore, that's a very, and if I'm willing to bet a lot of you have had the experience of becoming close with someone and you're sharing a relationship and it's really wonderful and they invite you over to their house for dinner and you say, no, thank you. It's like, wait, what just happened? I thought there was like a friendship here. I'm going to forget romance, you know? You understand then why he puts his finger on that is that there's some way in which the Jew holds himself apart. Right, and that I want you to keep in mind, because when we come at some point or another to the rise of political anti-Semitism within Germany, this is going to return in the words of Wilhelm Marr, who is the person who arguably coins the term anti-Semitism. It will be specifically this need for the Jews to hold themselves apart at the table, which is a very, I know you guys all chuckled, but it's a very deeply visceral thing. I hope no one here has ever had the experience of having to refuse to eat in the house of their own family, but I'm willing to bet it's happened. I've counseled many of my students. What do you do when you've come to the inner belief that you are obligated to act in a certain way, and the context within which you live doesn't reflect that? How do you negotiate that split? Because on some level, no matter how you package it, you know what you're saying? I'm different than you. And the line between different and better, you guys all supplied it right away, right? And let's not forget, by the way, that one of the primary ways in which human psychology deals with situations of oppression is through inversion. Right? This is the ghetto superstar. I'm walking through the ghetto. The Poles are spitting on me and calling me Zid. And Zed. You know what I'm saying on the inside? I am the ghetto superstar. I can take the Gemara. I can tie it in knots, flip it up backwards, sideways. You stupid guy. Meaning, I've inverted the oppression and elevated myself above the people who see me as inferior. You understand how that's a basic psychological move? And it will play itself out a lot in Jewish history. But what else does he say? He contemplates, I have so many quotes here from the book, but we don't have enough time to drag you through them. So maybe I'll end with this, is that it's actually the unique part of the book is an element of realpolitik, as we would call it, right? Is that he, on the surface, he respects prophetic tradition. He does give lip service to the idea that, no, of course, everything was set, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he brings to bear specifically what's called siba ativit, natural causality, something which the Jews had absorbed in philosophy and science, largely from the Muslims. People remember Averroes, right, and who was considered the great heretic of thought of the Middle Ages. He was a Muslim scholar of jurisprudence, of Islamic jurisprudence, who had very specific theological beliefs. He was also one of the major translators of Aristotle, from the Greek into Arabic, and brought, it was one of the major vehicles via which Aristotle came to the Christian world. But one of the keys is that one of the very core elements of his belief is natural causality, that God doesn't micromanage. And if God doesn't micromanage, then how do I relate to history? I mean, because the messianic, or let's just say prophetic worldview, because it doesn't have to be messianic, messianic is about how it's going to end. But the prophetic worldview is history is a revelation of God's will. Therefore, in a simplistic sense, I can know exactly what God thinks just by looking at what's happening. Now, that may leave me in a theologically uncomfortable place. So then I'll come with answers. So, oh, why are the Jews suffering? Well, the Christians will say, why are the Jews suffering? Because the Christians share the belief that history is a revelation of God's will. Why are the Jews suffering? Because they rejected salvation. So the Jews are stuck because we agree that history is a revelation of God's will, but we don't believe with their conclusion. So our answer is no, because of our sins we were exiled from our land. But notice they're fundamentally, from a philosophical standpoint, the same premise. Right? So, but Ibn Virga will be one of the first to introduce, well, we were exiled from Spain because of politics and economics and because Ferdinand has his own perspective. Now notice, he's also taking the moralist stance because we're superior or because we're being, you know, because it's really hard on the Christians when we act different. And he's one of the first people to offer this sort of like universalist tinged pragmatism. And the reason I keep saying that universalist tinge is he's not a universalist. He just told you he believed the Jews are superior, right? But as soon as you move out of the prophetic into the pragmatic, you're moving toward the universal, right? Socioeconomics nominally are the same everywhere, nominally. We actually now know that it's not true, but certainly at this point, they're moving toward that. And just to give you the final image, got 1 minute left, you know who his contemporary was? Machiavelli. Who were you gonna say? Yeah. Well, and you know, Machiavelli, famously, of course, for being Machiavellian. No, it's like, let's just not forget that Machiavelli's sort of great innovation in thought is that he really emancipated politics from both theology and moral philosophy. Right? He was just telling you what rulers actually do, and therefore what is useful and effective to get what they want. Right? And you'll notice that the extreme formation, and by the way, he praises Ferdinand as the prototype of what the prince should be. Why? because he did exactly what he needed to do to consolidate his power, and he didn't blink at the consequences, right? And so, therefore, one of the questions that comes up, and we'll pursue the model a little bit further later, for me, is that when you make this split between the prophetic messianic and the universalist pragmatist, we're all trained in a Western secular culture. We tend to lean toward the latter. But don't forget that when you take a moral message out of the story of history, you very easily open the door to Machiavelli. So we will come back to this question of how the exiles deal with their experience going forward in the next class.
This was a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. To learn more about sponsoring a podcast, please contact Jamie at pardes.org.